This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. The state of wild and sour beer in America is rapidly evolving. And this year, in partnership with Green Bench Brewing in St. Petersburg, Florida, the GBH team hosted a series of interviews and discussions at their Fooder for Thought Festival. These discussions are meant to help us all dig into the future of this loosely defined but highly sought after category of beers. It's also a chance to get to know some of the people and stories behind how these beers are made, sold, and enjoyed all over the country. In this five-part series, you'll hear from a variety of perspectives from this niche of the industry. In this episode, we talk to Chase Healy of American Solera. Listen in.
All right, here we are. We're going to talk to Chase Healy.
Yeah,
of American
yeah.
Solera.
Thank you. Thank you to all 20 of you.
I said it really loud, hoping that the name American Solera just sounds like a Ferrari to me. So I'm hoping that they start to come this way.
The jokes will start to flow, and the crowd will start to flock.
We have a brewer here, all the way from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. How many people here have been to Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Yeah, there's like...
Oh, that was like four more than I thought we were going to get.
It's an up-and-coming city, Michael.
I do mention Tulsa in a way because the first question I wanted to ask you is about operating something like American Solera in a place that, for all intents and purposes, is pretty far from where the scenes are that we associate with these kinds of beers.
Sure.
We tend to think of like major metropolitan areas where most of, you know, just the density alone... And the food environment, the culinary scenes and things like that tend to drive a lot of that kind of drinking culture. But like we've seen from so many of these kinds of breweries, they're starting them in places that don't necessarily have those kinds of cultures. Mm-hmm. And they're building up a base kind of from scratch. And I'm kind of curious as to, I've never personally been to Tulsa. So
sure.
I kind of wanted to help have you paint a little bit of a picture for me of what food and beverage is really about there, and then we can talk about where Wild Ales fits in.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing about Tulsa, and I think and its strength is being able to be the point of introduction for a lot of stuff. Because, I mean, it's still a city in the surrounding suburbs of 1 million people.
Yeah.
So it's not tiny. So the crowd is there, but maybe the education about beer just isn't. And like everywhere else, it's growing and growing and growing. And the one advantage we do have is being on some major highways and really being a few hours from Kansas City, a few hours from Dallas, and then, the next tier is those 6 hour or so drives to St. Louis or down to Austin. So we're kind of right in the middle of it. So you often find a lot of people travel Route 66 and come right through Tulsa. So a lot of people are coming through our state, most likely to go somewhere else. But inevitably, they do stop. So
yeah, and increasingly, I think it's becoming known for good breweries. You just happen to be associated with two of them.
Yes.
Because you were one of the co-founders of Prairie Artisan Ales as well.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what the relationship is of that brewery and what you're doing now and how that kind of works out in your head.
Great question. Well, so he asked that 2 years ago. I sold the brand rights to my production partner. Prairie started in 2012. We were making these farmhouse beers and stouts and unique things. And even back then, it was being in this place that it makes no sense and shipping that beer to Japan and all around the world. And that was exciting. And it grew and it grew. And honestly, it grew to a size that I didn't feel like I was really capable of continuing to drive it along. But the guys that have been there since day one, Krebs Brewing Company, where we were making the beer, were just in love with what was going on. And so they said, well, let us run with it. You can kind of, if you want to still make beer, then do that and help us when we need it. But we want to keep going. So it was interesting.
But it's not like you just started another offshoot of the same kind of brewery that's smaller.
No.
You started a whole different trajectory.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, the biggest focus for American Solera is blended food or aged sour beer, fitting that I'm on the stage here for Food or for Thought. But really, it was my desire to be focusing on slower turn, smaller projects, and just kind of getting in touch with the beer and kind of getting out of the way to let those guys just operate and make these beautiful beers that we've been creating and continue to run with that while I was kind of able to slow down a little bit, had a family, had kids, and that came with it, wanting to be maybe around home a little bit. And,
yeah, but they very still much be, went on two different paths that way.
Yeah, still be able to have my hands in the beer projects, but at a little slower pace.
Now, I've had a chance to talk to you a couple of times on occasion, and not too long ago, a couple of years ago at Shelton Fest for the podcast. One of the things I took away from that was a realization that when people start a business, which in this case is a brewery, they're often starting a business with a frame of mind around what a business is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that comes from people you know, or your parents, or maybe, you know, you have a brother or a sister that started a business, and like everybody's got these own sort of inputs as to like what constitutes a business, and in this case, maybe what constitutes a brewery.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of that came from your family, because there was business people in your family. That kind of, by the time that hour-long conversation circled all the way back around, I started to realize, like, the thing that you've always wanted to build is a small business, not this, like, ascendant growth kind of brand of Prairie, which is on an unbelievable track, but maybe didn't necessarily fit into your framework of what you wanted for your life and for your work to be.
I think as a young person, you're romanced by the idea of a brewery and making beer and selling it to people, and then inevitably that has to be a business. And so, like, I think, you know, starting in, you know, we launched Prairie, I think I was like 26 years old. And so going from that to where it is, you know, as of a couple years ago and as it is now, it kind of like happened, and it happened quicker than I was ready for. And so you just, I guess, start to realize, yeah, what you want. And small's nice. It has its disadvantages, you know, both other advantages and disadvantages. So, but the size we're at now is comfortable for me as my ability to manage, I guess.
One of the things I think I'd imagine that being part of founding Prairie prepared you for was a little bit of like a home and an away strategy. Like, where you're selling beer at home, you're a Tulsa brewery, you're a local brewery to some people.
Yes.
And then to other folks all over the country or all over the world, you're American Solera, the maker of these very specific beers that they're seeking out.
Yeah.
And that's a very sort of, I would imagine that it would be very difficult sometimes to, a lot of people learn this really quickly in the hard way, of like, I have a bipolar operation. I'm a small local brewery, and then I'm this like world-class, high, you know, distributed far, far away from home kind of brewery.
And there's detachment in that too, because like the local beer geeks and stuff, like they don't care, like they love coming to our brewery and they support the hell out of us, but they're around it, so like they're used to it. And so it's funny where I feel like we, in our hometown, and we have a second tap room like in an entertainment kind of area in our town now, is that we are now people's local brewery, and we can connect with them with tap beers and pub beers and IPAs and things. But when you come to an event like this and communicate with people outside of the country or on the coast, it's those slow turn, you know, very complex beers that we're able to have this conversation of beer outside of town. But it's crazy because the laws are changing in our state in a big way. Only a year and a half ago, we were allowed to start selling beer directly to people. The day that changed is when American Solera launched, August 26th of 2016. I didn't sold a drop until I could sell it directly to someone. But that changed, and now here in October, we'll be able to self-distribute. So like our laws are getting very progressive in our state, and it's opened up the doors for other people to open breweries, and it's opened up the doors for us to focus a lot on selling beer directly to people and across our bar and giving them an experience when they come to our place versus maybe finding it on the shelf.
What's important about that, to be able to sell it directly over your own bar? You mentioned experience. Like, what is it about?
It's connecting with people and making twice the money.
Right, sure.
That part's awesome.
Yeah, the margins are pretty helpful for us. I mean,
well, we're a small business that doesn't make a lot of beer. We're maybe make 1,000 barrels of beer this year, and if I distribute all that, like it's gonna be hard to stay open.
Well, I think that's
just a
helpful
strategy.
Contrast to something like Prairie, where because it is a larger production, you know, a larger producing brewery, the distribution and wholesale game starts to work for them once you get to a certain threshold of barrelage. But if you're planning on staying very small and making beers that take a long time to make, you need to kind of eke out as much margin as possible out of each one of those bottles to make it work.
Exactly.
There's not really a history of, you know, much of a history since Prohibition of making small, you know, very, very small breweries making a small amount of beer for a high margin. It's a very new kind of model.
Right.
But you also mentioned experience, and being able to do that over your own bar creates something different for a customer than it would be if they just ordered it off a list somewhere far away.
Absolutely.
What do you want somebody to take away from your tap room when they're ordering and drinking those beers? Like, how do you think about your staff's interaction with them? Like, do you do any training or What kind of education do you employ? Like, what do you do to make that the best experience possible?
I mean, the biggest thing with the staff is treating them like family and doing dinner and opening the beers and talking with them and really developing their palates so they can get people excited about our beer. And it's not ordering off a menu. It's asking, what should I have? Here's what I like. The new spot's just a total neighborhood feel. And it's crazy when you come into our tap room that's like, you know, in a neighborhood with a coffee roaster and the houses, like I can walk there from my house and there's like two IPAs, Imperial Stout, five fruit beers, and then a Helles because you got to drink lagers. But we have a really crazy tap list for a place that people come drink casually now.
Right. I think that's quietly happening in places. Before we get into that, so Bob mentioned earlier that accessibility was really important to him, and draft, having his stuff on draft at bars around town is a big part of that. People are going to order that and drink it, you know, for $6 a pour versus buying a big bottle. Mm-hmm. You opening up the new tap room, it seems very intentional that you put it in the middle of town where it's a little bit more accessible and casual, and
yeah,
it's not just people who are seeking you out as a destination for like Wild and Sour Ales that are
right.
Stopping in. Like, these are people that are stopping in because maybe they just want to go to a bar.
That's just it. I mean, our other spot is a destination as far as its proximity to town, where this is convenient for people on the way home, so it's a whole different ball game.
How did you think about the experience you wanted to offer between those? Because that's a very different customer you have in mind, a very different place. You
yeah.
have to be accommodating to, you know, very different expectations. What were some of the things that are different about the tap room that you have in town versus the destination spot?
The tap room we have in town is, there's like, it's very clean, it's very Scandinavian. It's really all about the beer, no TVs, only 25 seats. There's a patio, which helps when the weather's nice, but it is intimate and it is small. And it's nice because while a lot of people do stay and have several drinks, it's really easy for people to pop in, grab beer to go, and head where they're heading to, you know, out to dinner with friends or, you know, home. So,
yeah. But it sounds like you were also thinking about having a balanced tap list to offer a wide variety of people.
Yeah.
What does it do to a tap room sort of flow and the way that people order and drink to have something like a Helles on, whereas at a destination brewery, you know, you might just have...
Well, that's the difference than when people come to our brewery and drink and when people come to the tap room and drink. Because, I mean, I look at that stuff and it'll probably a little too much, like, how are sales, what's going on? If I pulled out my phone right now, 1 through 3 would be IPAs, number 4 would be the lager, and then we'd start hitting, like, our raspberry beer and then our grape beers, and it's like... So people want to just casually drink... IPAs and those types of beers and then experience our other beers. So it's the volume thing versus the sampling thing.
What are some of the beers that you're making now that you're most proud of?
Chris, which one is that?
Passion Fruit.
Okay.
So
So
you're just going to automatically say you're most proud of this one.
That one's great. That one's good. No, you know what? It was another one that I brought that y'all be able to try, the Beer to Pick Pool. It's a beer-wine hybrid. It was a collaboration with Field Recordings, which is a winemaker in Central California. And they pick grapes one evening and destemmed them and then literally loaded them on a truck and drove straight from California to Oklahoma, straight to the brewery that, like, 2 days later, and straight into our tanks, backflow with beer, and then punched down during fermentation. And we have something that is really inspiring for someone that's, like, kind of looking for that next angle with their beers and really playing heavily with grapes. Not like grape, you know, a little bit, but like to the point of probably breaking the law.
Yeah, above 50% fermentables. Yeah. I'm hearing that more and more recently of people who are experimenting with fruit to that level, and especially grapes.
Yeah.
Like, there seems to be some attraction and some interest in fermenting, you know, basically making a wine-beer hybrid right now. I guess beyond just the experimentation kind of quality of that, what do you think is pushing that kind of interest in that right now?
I know for me, and I mean the way we make beer, it's like I love wine. So it's like the way that I can interact with it, because I'm not going to be a winemaker, but this like lets me play in that world a little bit and kind of feel like I'm making something close to wine. So
I was hoping I was going to get some of that.
There you go. Can I have some too, please?
Thank you. Watch that cactus.
I know, dude. I'm only renting that.
But so I remember when I was like 20 years old and thinking, making beer sounds cool, making wine sounds cool. You know, I'm thinking I'm going to go with beer because it's ready and a few weeks, and wine takes like a year or more, and now I'm making some beers that take years to make. So joke's on me. But living in Oklahoma, too, like the wine thing was never going to pan out. So I guess always being interested in it and finding a way to do what I'm doing and interact in that world a little bit.
What does it mean to you that you're able to start a brewery that makes these kind of beers and you're able to do it at home versus having to go to a, you know, winemakers kind of have to be in a certain market to make it work.
Yeah.
The wines grow in a certain area. The grapes grow in a certain area. And we see some of it scattered around in the Midwest and upstate New York, and some are better off that way than others. But a brewery can kind of start anywhere to a certain degree, depending on what you want to make.
Yeah.
And you're able to make world-class sour wild ales in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You're close to family. Like, it seems like it's more than just a practical choice. Like, it seems like there's an emotional quality to being able to be home and do that stuff.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's creating something for your city. Our city is, like, exciting and growing, and there's lots of things happening, like lots of projects, lots of creativity happening. And so the thought of being able to create something that contributes to someone being thrilled that they are living in our town, like, feels good. And that was, like, just maybe where I've changed and grown as a person in general, as a business owner, as a brewer. Because back when we started this years ago, that wasn't the case, and we couldn't execute the beers the way we wanted to. And selling them to San Francisco, New York City, Chicago made a lot of sense because we were able to resonate with that type of drinker at the time. But now we can do it at home, too, because the culture's caught up.
Yeah. It seems a little bit more like what we're seeing with small cities all over the country now with chefs who maybe went off to San Francisco or New York or coming back home and opening restaurants.
Yep.
And they're creating a scene in their hometowns.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that that's one of the biggest benefits of small craft breweries has been able to offer is that kind of revitalization and excitement around food and beverage in their towns that you don't get necessarily from a bottle of wine from Napa that shows up on a shelf in Tulsa.
Right.
That's not really contributing anything from a cultural and like financial standpoint to that town in the same way that a small brewery is.
Definitely.
So being able to do that at home is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to you to be able to travel far from home to a place like this and share your beer?
It's exciting. I'm like,
what do you hope to take away from things like this?
What the hell are they doing having me get up on stage to talk about this stuff? It's funny and it's an honor, honestly. It's an honor to think that people would care enough about what I've done to even sit here and hear what I might say is kind of blows my mind, honestly.
And what are you pouring today?
We're pouring the passion fruit beer. It's one of our fooder blends, re-fermented on passion fruit. The beer to pick pool is the 50-50 pick pool grapes in our fooder beer, re-fermented. And that's really my favorite, the pick pool. And it's a sleeper one, because tomorrow at Hunapu Day, we'll pour the Zinfandel beer. And it's definitely outsold the pick pool, because it's bold and big and really intense. But this one's elegant.
It's also got the word Zinfandel.
And that
that's helpful.
That helps it, along with some obscure Mediterranean grape that no one's really ever heard of.
but I like that one. Which is arguably a cooler word.
It is. It's a fun beer, and yeah, just I appreciate everyone that's sitting here listening to my words right now. Thank you.
I'm gonna come down. I've got the mic with me. I'm gonna come down for some Q&A. If anybody has a particular question, raise your hand. I'll come to you. Right here in the front row.
Wow.
Service.
How do you feel about carb and like extending your emphasis? That makes a word. Like, doing carbonation. How you doing it? And, like, you guys are obviously doing very well on your carbonation. Do you guys have a team that does it? What's going on?
I couldn't quite hear him that.
So he was asking about... So he was asking about carbonation.
Carbonation.
I know that carbonation is something that people are experimenting with in both directions right now. Whether still they're going high or going all the way down to still.
Yeah.
What are some of the things on your mind for that?
Especially
for lagers.
Lagers, I mean, the biggest thing we're doing with our lagers is we have a horizontal lagering tank and capping the tank off before fermentation is complete to get a small amount of natural. And we pump them the rest of the way with regular CO2. The carbonation thing has been something I've really been focusing on lately, because I really want to give people that effervescent experience in our beers. And it's been complicated with these really old beers and hitting where you want to on them. And to now we're to the point where we're using probably more science and math than we ever have before. We've bought a carbo-doser and are shaking our old beer and finding out the dissolved CO2 and really pushing those volumes upward. It's just like we had a formula and it works pretty good, but pretty good's not good enough anymore. So it's getting every bit of data and number we can before, you know, testing beer before we fruit it, after we fruit it, and just like really understanding where that end point is when things are terminal and making sure we're hitting the numbers we're striving for. So it's been something that's really been a focus of mine lately.
Okay. Why don't you come on up and grab a yard? We're getting a little feedback when I take it down there.
Hello. Hello. I'm from over there. You mentioned tomorrow, I just had the beer to Big Pull. So it's the Big Pull grape blend with the beer, and you're doing the Zinfandel tomorrow at Hunapu. Being that, I guess, it's clear that you very much do like wine and things like that, do you have a particular region for wine, specifically maybe Zinfandel, that you prefer? I know I love
it. I don't know that I dove deep enough into this yet to really have that kind of preference. It's just like getting Zinfandel grapes from California is going to be a hell of a lot better than getting Zinfandel grapes from Oklahoma. that's just the nature of agriculture, I suppose. So these are fantastic Central California, Central Coast grapes that it felt like cheating. They were so good. So. You know, I like to use more local things, but, you know, we can get really great stuff we run with it. But the more we dive into it, I hope we can come up with more from other
regions. It
seems
like there's a difference in intent there between wanting to express something local, like a locally raised fruit that's identified with the area, versus wanting the best grapes you can get to make this particular kind of profile you're looking for. Like, the intent's there.
And both have their, reasons I think that anyone would pursue it one way or another. Both are I think great pursuits. So I can't blame someone that can do it. We can do peaches.
People look at the hops. People look at hops and malts the same way.
Yeah.
There's you want character from local when that matters to the beer you're trying to make.
Sure.
Otherwise you're trying to get the best ingredients you can.
And for me it's all a pursuit of like flavors and so getting stuff from far away is still exciting to experiment and play. I mean, I would say that that's like maybe a turning point in our business from where it's been and where it is now to where it's going is like everything over the last year and a half has just been a big experimentation, even with our branding and the beers we're making. Like there is no business model that I have written for what I'm doing. It's we make things that we're excited about and then we get inspired and make the next thing. And I probably need to start shifting towards like being a little more organized, but like it's worked so far. But yeah, that's just kind of where we're coming from right now.
We have time for a third one. Yeah, come on up.
So Chase, I have a podcast as well, What Ails You, and we get to know the brewers, and we talk about a lot about family. And obviously Colin was with you a lot with Prairie, doing a lot of the design and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How was that? Is Colin never jumping on board to help you with that, like illustration? Is it
he
more
helped
family
with the
there?
First couple labels for me. They're actually Colin's work, and then we just realized that it was too much to have to be creative in two different ways for two different things, and it made more sense for him to focus on those for sure. But I mean, it's funny, like his studio's still set up in the brewery, and like I see him every day. And
awesome. Okay.
You know,
good,
my
good.
Wife works full time. My mom and my mother-in-law work in my tap room.
Get out! Really?
My sister-in-law. So it's we're a family business to a fault, but it's awesome.
So two tap rooms now.
Mm-hmm.
What are the growth expectations for Solera? Is there a place that you feel like you need to keep it to feel connected and contained?
Oh, not necessarily. It's just like comfort, I guess. You're right. So I don't know that we need to make a lot more beer. I'm happy making 1-2,000 barrels a year. And we got a crew of a couple guys and me. And I'm finding myself more pulled out of the brewery and more actually having to plan and make decisions for the brewery than I get to have my hands dirty. But I'm pretty comfortable with where we are. I think my guys would argue they want to put they're younger and maybe like a lot more like energized and ambitious. And I'm like, we're cool. Like, I'd be cool if we just made some beers and hung out. And they're like, no, we want to, like, make this thing awesome. And it's great to have people that are behind you like that too, that that even push me.
What do you want your takeaway to, what do you think your takeaway from this week is going to be when you head back home?
Oh, wow.
I'd imagine every time you travel, like, you're just getting inundated with new things, new people. It's a lot to take in and sort out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know what the biggest thing for me is, like, feeling like I can leave my brewery and count on my guys to execute while I'm gone is a big thing that, like, I have to be able to leave and let them, trust them to take care of business, and we grow immensely as a company when I can be okay, because it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard when you set out to do something where you want to touch it all and be involved, and to be able to let go a little bit and know that you train these people and they're going to execute because they're just as proud of it as you are. I need to leave like this to let that happen so we can grow our business in new ways.
Create space for them.
Mm-hmm.
Jason, I appreciate you talking to us today
and
sharing these great beers.
And I will say that I would be wearing your beautiful lager sweatshirt that I ordered and you mailed me recently, but like, I am too fat for
the largest.
They run a little slim. So warning, it's a beautiful, awesome sweatshirt, but if you're fat like me, you'll have to get it, and then it'll be your goal sweatshirt, which is a funny concept, too.
Order up a size.
Yeah.
It says lager on it. It's not for skinny people. Thanks, guys. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks to Green Bench Brewing for putting in the amount of work necessary to pull this festival off, especially in the middle of the Tampa St. Pete Beer Week. They continue to make a name for themselves amongst both the producers and fans of these beers, and their commitment to the educational and intellectual pursuit of these things is really a gift to the whole industry. Also, shoutouts to Craft Brands and Rocky Mountain Barrel Company for sponsoring the festival and helping make all this possible. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Hope to see you next year.